Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight on this Thursday evening. We don't do many functions on Thursday, but it was great to get the Minister to come here tonight, and we're very grateful that he's here. Thanks also to Gilbert and Tobin for providing this fine facility this evening. Peter Garrett is known very well. He must be one of the best known Australians. So I'll be very brief in my introduction. He makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was last year when Labor was in opposition. He was educated in arts at the ANU in Canberra and law at UNSW. I guess he's best known, as some would say, an entertainer with Midnight Oil. I would say someone who ran a small business, because that's essentially what Midnight Oil was. So you can't say he's without business ability, because if you run any kind of successful business, you've got some business ability. And he has a background, of course, in the Australian Conservation Foundation. He held a number of important positions when Labor was in opposition, then Minister for Environment, Heritage and the Arts, and more recently Minister for School Education, Early Childhood and Youth, and of course since 2004 as the Member for Kingsford Smith. And tonight the Minister is going to talk to the Sydney Institute on the topic developing a uniquely Australian school education system. Peter Garrett, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard, and I want to begin by acknowledging traditional owners and custodians of the land. Gerard, to yourself and to Anne Henderson, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, Danny Gilbert, thank you for Gilbert and Tobin's hospitality, and my secretary, Lisa Paul, from the department, who's come up for this speech as well. It's great to be here with you. Education is the key to our prospects as a nation, so it's a real pleasure to have this opportunity to outline the context and goals of the most significant Commonwealth reforms to school education for decades. The fact is that the depth and breadth of education reform by this government is unprecedented. This is acknowledged, I think, even by our critics. However, the overarching design of the reform is less well understood. So this evening I want to lay out for you the shape and substance of this design and explain why the government has embarked on a task of this magnitude and what we're intending to achieve. Ensuring a world-class education for its citizens is a nation-building enterprise, and for education reform to be successful for all Australians, it has to be a national enterprise. A shared national enterprise, but a national enterprise nevertheless. Our school education's unique in public policy terms because it reaches into every household in a way that's manifestly different to other arms of government. So we all recognise its importance on a personal level. It provides experiences that stay with us forever. But education's reach is broad. Education also provides us with a productive future workforce. Education delivers an informed citizenry. Above all, education's a great enabler, creating scientists and mathematicians, artists and tradesmen, doctors, lawyers, and dare I say it, politicians. It unlocks potential that lies within every person. It lifts us up to realise our dreams and ambitions. And whilst human beings are much more than just workers, and our school systems must recognise this, it is the case that the benefits of education to each individual aggregate to strengthen communities and workplaces. As the Australian philosopher Raymond Guider reminds us, every individual is unique and irreplaceable. But school education is not something that can be left to chance or personal circumstance. It's not in the nation's interest to allow this to happen, particularly at this moment in our history. If we are to have a productive, prosperous, and sustainable future, it will be built on the capacity of our people. And capacity building starts at school. I sometimes fear that the mentality summed up in Donald Horne's Lucky Country has returned to us with a vengeance. We're all benefiting from the resources boom in the same way we rode on the sheep's back. But we need to build the foundations of a modern economy that's diverse and resilient, that produces quality services and high-paid jobs, that ensures long-term prosperity as we exploit our natural advantages in the one-off export of mineral wealth. With the world going through a period of flux and seismic economic shift as the Asian century unfolds, we are well placed to emerge as a high-skill, high-wage, modern economy. But only if we do the hard yards of preparation now. We should be a nimble, creative, empathic and problem-solving people, so as we reap the benefits of our mineral resources at the same time, we must prepare for the time beyond the boom. And here, the standard of our education, as is widely acknowledged, is crucial. We can continue to create a better society, and Australia's already an exemplar of this, through the quality of the citizens developed in part through our schools. A school education system that delivers opportunity to each and every citizen is the hallmark of successful democratic nations. Historically, the Australian education system has tended to drift along without direction or rational reform. It's an education system that has emerged without national planning or preparation, or indeed a great deal of design. And evidence is beginning to appear that it is no longer serving us as well as it should. It was a desire to seize the reins and to redesign and revitalise school education that guided my predecessor as Education Minister, now the Prime Minister, Julia Gillard. I believe that the impact of the Labor government's education reforms are as significant and will be as long-lasting as any education reform initiated by any Australian government. It's a bold claim, but I believe justifiable. So, why the need to improve our education system? Well, the OECD program for international student assessment, known to some of us as PISA, those results are an international league table of sorts. The best world education systems deliver high equity and high outcomes. That is, their best students achieve very high results, and they don't have an extended cohort, what's called an equity tail, of underperformance. Now, Australian students perform well in PISA, with achievement above the international average in reading, maths and science. But between 2000 and 2009, our results declined while other countries improved. The Gonski Review in School Funding, which I'll come to later, underlines this. 2009 PISA data tells us that 25% of Australian students from the lowest SES backgrounds are failing to reach minimum proficiency levels across all of the literacy domains tested. This means they don't read or write at the level they should. Their numeracy skills are poor. It inhibits their growth in maths and English and in all other school subjects. They fall slowly further behind. By year nine, the data tells us that the gap between these students and their peers from high SES backgrounds is equivalent to almost 3 years of schooling. Without competent literacy or numeracy skills, these students are effectively excluded from meaningful participation in much of the high school curriculum. And of course, their long-term personal and work prospects are grim. Most of these kids are from poor families. There are other factors that intersect and compound this disadvantage, Indigenous students, students with disabilities, kids from the bush, most don't do as well as they should. They all do it tougher than my kids and most likely yours. But this is not just their problem or their mum and or their dad's problem. It's our problem. Doing nothing is not an option. Every educator, every business leader, and every parent says this to me in a variety of ways and in a variety of forums. And while our performance languishes, other countries have identified what they need to do and are improving at a rate of knots. With widespread agreement about the importance of education, it's the debate about how we boost results that is beginning to command everyone's attention, as it should. So, what should we do to improve? At the high equity, high performance end of the PISA results sits Finland and some of our near neighbours in East Asia. Finland has very high university entrance requirements for studying teaching. In Finland, school students have regular play periods. There's no or little homework and no full cohort testing. By way of contrast, you may have also noticed recent reporting on East Asian education performance. Now, four of the world's five highest performing education systems are Hong Kong, Korea, Shanghai, and Singapore. In Shanghai, the average 15-year-old math student is performing at a level 2 or 3 years above his or her counterpart in Australia, the USA, or Europe. But the East Asian systems are in many ways totally different to Finland in relation to student testing, teaching methodology, the role of kids' play, the length of the school day, the amount of homework, the methods of teaching, and the curriculum. So, if Australia is to learn from the best, in inverted commas, overseas systems, there are a range of questions to be answered. Do we centralise our bureaucracy or devolve it? Do we give hours of homework or none? Do we double teachers' pay or make it easier to sack them? Do we have sample testing or full cohort testing? Do we let teachers write the curriculum or make sure everyone is taught the same one? Do we prioritise English, maths and science? Or do we see the arts as fundamental to a fully rounded education? Brackets not in the formal remarks of the speech. I think you know where some of my sympathies will lie on that last question. Close brackets. Are decisions best made at the centre of large systems or by individual schools? What do we learn from looking overseas? That's the big question. Well, a few things jump out. In these high-performing countries, they began reforming and planning for long-term success some time ago. Not success in 5 years or 10, but in the case of Finland, for well over a generation. Careful, long-term planning. Finland, in particular, after World War II, decided education was the driver for an economic shift away from declining primary industries and into the knowledge economy. They made a conscious decision and knew that results would only come over the long haul. A good lesson for Australia. Secondly, all these different systems developed their educational model in response to their context, their history, their cultural mix and ethnic diversity, their conceptual understandings of how knowledge is constructed and how it should be transmitted. And most importantly, they had a clear line of sight to what they believe education should deliver, what a student should know, understand, and be able to do at the end of the schooling process. These are important lessons to learn. The individual programs and policies in these successful systems are worthy of close examination, but our education architecture needs to be purpose-built. It needs to deliver for all students, reflect our challenges, respect our history, and suit our context and our perspective of the future. It needs to be an Australian education system that is both high equity and delivers excellence and responds to our specific needs, reflecting Australia's history of finding a balance that suits us. Our challenge is to reconcile the specific history of how school education has evolved in this country with a better system that is ready for the 21st century. One thing's clear, maintaining the status quo is no longer good enough. In 2007, this government inherited a patchwork system of different standards of curriculum, of teaching, of teacher training, of access to technology, of equity programs, and of school funding. And we knew that we could do better. So we began to build a new architecture for Australian schooling. Transparency, accountability, measurement, investment in what counts, investing $65 billion over 4 years, doubling the school education budget. There were clear problems with the existing system, 8 different curricula, 8 teacher accreditation systems, and so on. And some of these flaws in Australian education invited national solutions. Some required national leadership. And what was overdue was an all-encompassing framework in which schools, all schools, could flourish. We made clear choices regarding which elements of education needed to be common and universal, and which should be determined closer to the ground. In all of this, we were clear that schools should not resemble franchised outlets of mass education, isolated from neighbourhoods, but should be unique, lively, and fully engaged and integrated with their communities. At the same time, common, high-quality curriculum and outstanding teachers are necessary in every school. Our answers are different to East Asia and different to Finland and Europe. They're specifically Australian responses because states and territories and school sectors run schools, and any reform requires their close collaboration and often their agreement. And the national education architecture I'm referring to has all been delivered through the prism of these tensions. What should be local or jurisdictional, and what is the role of the Commonwealth? First cab off the rank was transparency. Publicly accounting for public expenditure is an important principle. In education, this had an important further dimension too. Allowing a light to shine on schools was also a catalyst for an ongoing debate about improvement and about failure. We didn't know what was happening in schools for far too long. And my school was a very big rock thrown into the centre of the education pond. Concurrently, we began the process of introducing a high-quality Australian curriculum which sets out a consistent approach to what students learn across the country. A curriculum that's a common learning entitlement, a powerful cultural statement about who we are as a nation and what is important for our future citizens to know. And it shouldn't be greatly different in remote far north Queensland than it is in the suburbs of Sydney or Melbourne. Now, just like the railroad tracks meeting at the borders at the same width, we're seeing an Australian curriculum rolling out across the country. Nor should it be compromised by the teacher in the classroom. And the common thread that runs through the successful education systems of East Asia and Finland is teacher quality. But what does teacher quality look like? And are we creating the conditions to produce quality teachers? And we've moved decisively into that debate, attacking it at all points. Preparation and training, standards to identify quality, teacher rewards and educational leadership. So we've introduced new minimum teacher training requirements, set the bar higher in terms of entry levels to teaching, and made sure that teachers have content qualifications. We've introduced national professional standards for teachers and school principals. The teaching standards have created the opportunity to introduce merit pay for the first time. Old, yearly salary progression systems are breaking down. From next year, every teacher in the country will be entitled to effective performance management and support. And for some of them, this will be the first time that it has happened. But getting the national architecture right is only half the battle. We all know that the hard work of education happens in the nation's schools. An Australian education system needs to be founded on quality schools. And our schools are filled with tertiary educated, creative individuals who can manage, organise and problem solve. But in many cases, the formula gets in the way of the better solution, namely the local solution. And we're working with state and territory governments to try and change this. We call it Empowering Local Schools. It has similar names in different states and territories, but it's a change driven by Commonwealth investment and quickly gathering momentum. Commonwealth investment will allow schools to control more of their finances, their staffing, or their governance. And states and territories and non-government sectors have enthusiastically embraced this initiative. We've introduced national partnerships with states and territories to improve the literacy and numeracy results of low SES students and to raise the bar on teacher quality. This is the first time that focused partnership investment in education, driven by the Commonwealth, has taken place on this scale. We're able to see what's working and use this knowledge to target investment. And while it's still early days, we've already seen improvement in schools receiving funding under the National Partnership for Literacy and Numeracy, including the Year 3 reading, where 70% of schools improved, and in Year 5 numeracy, where 75% of schools improved. And there are other reforms, national trade cadetships, computers in schools, all essential and many overdue. We've constructed, piece by piece, new national education architecture that balances school empowerment with national standards. We've put design back into the system. Robust, long-term policies that will bear fruit over the next decade. And it's a significant accomplishment. But this brings us to school funding. How schools are funded has long been a point of contention in education, the media and the community, and I dare say that is an understatement. Acres of print, too much of it, ideological, vituperative and unhelpful, has been used in the coverage of this issue. But school funding remains an issue that needs to be addressed. Australia has a unique system of schooling. It's based on the organic growth of government, independent and Catholic schools delivering education through states and territories. We have 8 separate education jurisdictions and a non-government sector that is larger than in most other comparable nations. Government schools provide access for all students, irrespective of personal circumstance, and remain the backbone of our education system. They educate the majority of Australian students and do most of the heavy lifting. Non-government schools provide choice via a wide range of religious, cultural, or pedagogical beliefs and complement government schools. They provide a valuable educational counterpoint in policy and practice and are integral to Australian education. A mixed education system has always existed in Australia. The Gillard government recognises what the sectors offer and respects them for their role and contribution. Our composite schooling models come about through some unique circumstances. I won't go into the details here, but if I mention Henry Parkes, the Public Instruction Act of 1880, sectarianism, the Goulburn Strike, the state aid debates in the Labor Party, the Carmel Report, and the Schools Commission, the education historians and others in the room will know what I'm talking about. 50 years after the Goulburn Strike, Non-government schools are funded by all Australian governments. They are firmly established as part of the education landscape. Today, one-fifth of the nation's students are currently enrolled in 1,700 Catholic schools. And 551,000 students are enrolled in over 1,000 independent schools. Christian, Anglican, Lutheran, Steiner, Montessori, Islamic, Seventh-day Adventist, and so on. These days, only the most blinkered of advocates sees government and non-government schooling as an either-or proposition. If we start with the present Australian schooling system and deal with what's in front of us, we can quickly dispense with the weaker arguments that we're hearing at the moment. Firstly, the purest pro-government school line, that non-government schools shouldn't be funded. As a serious proposition, it's dead and buried. And dead and buried not because of some failure of will by government, but because it's bad policy. Non-government schools are the clear choice of roughly 40% of the population. They are a distinctive and valued part of Australian education. Also easily rejected is the full privatisation of government schools as if through the magic of the market, successful schools would flourish and poor schools would wither on the vine. Failing schools would be forced to close down as parents voted with their feet in that case, except of course a sizeable whack of kids would be left behind, sitting in failing schools, waiting for them to close or for moving on to the next failing school. We all have a responsibility for all kids. We can't leave kids behind because their parents haven't exercised choice or have made poor choices or their chosen school hasn't been good enough. Every school must be able to deliver quality to every student. And Labor is absolutely unequivocal about this. The latest funding argument that's emerged characterises government school funding advocates as choosing equity over excellence. According to this argument, government schools, in their misguided desire to promote equality of outcomes, not only sacrifice excellence, but are opposed to it. Non-government schools must be saved from the reductionism and conformity of equity arguments. So the argument goes. Any discussion of school funding is a covert attempt to destroy non-government schooling and reduce quality. I think of this as the puerile undergraduate libertarianism of Ayn Rand applied to Australian education. I reject this argument. We can have both equity and excellence, and it can be delivered through both government and non-government schools. And the fact is, that's already happening. Despite increasingly hysterical comments from opposition education spokesman Christopher Pyne, there is no secret plan to undermine non-government schools. As an aside, I should say it would be a pleasing, although unlikely, development if he also supported the parents who choose government schools and defended their choices. But the fact is, this government's track record demonstrates unwavering even-handedness. We've invested $2.5 billion in national partnerships across all three sectors. Our More Support for Students with Disability policy, our Chaplains program, Computers in Schools, the BER, each and every initiative across government, independent and Catholic schools. Each reform has been consciously implemented to avoid favouring one school over another or one sector over another. We have established on that basis our bona fides for entering the funding debate. Now, as you know, in 2010, the government commissioned the first comprehensive review of school funding since the Carmel Report, nearly four decades ago. David Gonski, Ken Boston, Catherine Greiner, Bill Scales, Carmen Lawrence and Peter Tannock have done a terrific job. And their recently released report has been widely praised by education stakeholders. It tells us why we need to act. It's a historic, once-in-a-generation opportunity. It's a genuine game-changer in education. The report provides the platform we needed for a proper national conversation about how schools should be funded. The review panel found, and I quote, "Australia lacks a logical, consistent, and publicly transparent approach to funding schooling. And we will never realise the full potential of our school system and achieve the highest standard for students while the school funding system is broken." Essentially, the way schools are funded is a mess. I once, I think, accurately referred to it as a dog's breakfast. And Gonski found that similar schools are funded differently, that there's little relationship between the way schools are funded and the costs of effective education, and the respective roles of the Commonwealth, state and territories are not rational or coordinated. The Gonski report found that our broken funding model is now getting in the way of school and student performance. Some kids are being left behind. The education gap between Indigenous students and the rest, whilst well known, is a national tragedy. It's a similar story with a cohort of poor performing students. And when these students are left behind, we lose their potential as scientists, as tradespeople, engineers, Nobel laureates, whatever it is they have the capacity to achieve. The current funding model is also unfair. It's unfair within and across the government and non-government school sectors. The anomalies that are there cause division and animosity. So the real debate, which the opposition is pretending isn't happening, is all about the level of funding and where it should be targeted. It's not about government versus non-government schools. Now, Christopher Pyne attacked the Gonski report within minutes of its release, a 286-page report that took over a year to prepare with 26 findings and 41 recommendations, read, reflected and rejected within the space of half an hour. It simply didn't serve his purpose to amplify division and to fan hostility. Now, Labor has a very different view. The Gonski report gives us a clear reason to act and recommends a funding model that's a good starting point. A new funding model called a Schooling Resource Standard, or SRS. Under this system, schools would receive a base level of funding per student. There would then be extra money to recognise schools and students where needs are higher and the challenges greater in relation to poverty, location, disability, indigeneity and English language proficiency. The SRS funding model would allocate education funding on the basis of school and student need. But the panel members also concluded that significant further work was needed to test and develop the different elements of this kind of model. The model proposed is very different to the way schools are currently funded, and shifting nearly 10,000 schools onto a new funding model would be a huge undertaking. It would impact on all existing arrangements and school funding providers and has significant implications for governments. So we're taking the next steps carefully and methodically. We have a tight work plan that will investigate and test the Gonski SRS Schooling Resource Standard model. The work plan to do that was agreed by education ministers at last week's Ministerial Council, and that's a significant step forward. I've established a Ministerial Schools Funding Reference Group of all key stakeholders and state and territory governments, and that reference group met for the first time just a fortnight ago. State and territory and Catholic and independent sector representatives have been included in working groups to look at the various elements of the Gonski model. There's an established strategic policy working group which does the hard graft and provides advice to the Ministerial Council overseeing this work. And we expect that stakeholders will remain committed to the task. States and territories are equal partners in this, and the Ministerial Council will remain the key decision-making body under the Council of Australian Governments, COAG. COAG meets this Friday, and school funding is on the agenda. We're talking to parents, teachers, schools, and communities across the country, as I'm talking to you. It's a national conversation on schooling. Nothing has yet been decided, and no funds have been committed. That's because there's important work yet to be done. We need to look at the model, test it out, consult closely with stakeholders, and discuss it at Ministerial Council and COAG. This was explicit in the Gonski Review report, and I propose to you that it is the most prudent way to act in these circumstances. At the end of the day, we need a model that we are confident will work, and where this confidence is shared by stakeholders and governments. It's simply premature to be talking dollars. Any new system must meet our test that no school will lose a dollar per student. Any new model must also be an improvement on the current situation. It must be effective, fair, and sustainable. I'm working towards having legislation introduced into the Australian Parliament this year. To conclude, I'm confident that this period will come to be recognised as a time when our unique Australian school system emerged with its distinctive flavour and its robust design and architecture. An Australian school system with a national architecture, delivering high quality education through a mix of vibrant local schools. An Australian school system that understands, reconciles and celebrates its history and recognises that education is an enterprise shared by states and territories, schools, systems, parents and the community. An Australian school system where all stakeholders share a common understanding of fairness and where school funding is no longer a divisive issue. An Australian education system that sets us up for the future. The Gillard government recognises the national importance of school education and has acted decisively and responsibly. And our education partners and our stakeholders also have acted with maturity and integrity in the interests of all. Australian students now and into the future deserve nothing less. Thanks very much.
Many thanks to Peter Garrett for an important speech. Thanks also to Gilbert and Tobin for this fine facility this evening. So we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish just on 7 o'clock, so we've got plenty of time. There are a lot of people here, so keep your comments or questions brief and on the topic, on the broad topic. As you know, Mr. Garrett, the Prime Minister, when she was Education Minister, announced what became the Gonski Report of the Sydney Institute about 2 years ago, I think in February 2010, and she made the commitment there that you've repeated tonight that no school would lose a dollar. But I guess the argument goes, as you well understand, whether that commitment was in real terms or in nominal terms. And I know whilst you haven't made any decisions of funding yet, have any decisions been made about that principle, about whether the promise is to real or nominal money?
Look, thank you for the question, Jared. And the answer is that the commitment that no school will lose a single dollar per student as a consequence of any reforms is absolute. At the same time, we have said quite clearly that it is our expectation that indexation would be a feature of any new proposed funding model. Now, the nature of that indexation would be a matter to be agreed and work through with states, territories and school systems, but our commitment on indexation is clear.
So they've got a question, Bill, and then John. Yes.
Minister, you
referred to... Just speak up a bit, please. Right.
You referred to the OECD to call the decline of Australia vis-a-vis the other countries. So therefore there's an imperative to act on this report as quickly as possible. What's the timetable? And do you see an absolute imperative in terms of time that we really need to have this implemented by such and such a time?
Well, thank you for that question as well. I think the thing that strikes me about the PISA results is the speed with which, or the relatively short period of time in which we're seeing relative decline in the performance of Australian students, whether they're our best performing students or the cohorts that I described in my speech as of people in the long equity tail. So I do believe that we need to move urgently on this matter, and I think the Gonski report has provided us with the necessary set of recommendations to consider and to roll up our sleeves and get that work done. As I said in my speech, I do want to introduce legislation into the Parliament this year. The working groups that I referred to in passing in my remarks have a great deal of important and challenging work to do, but I'm confident that we have the education expertise, both amongst stakeholders, and state and territory governments, to be able to bring a proposition for consideration for agreement by Council of Australian Governments in the time that we've set.
John Tierney.
Thank you. Minister, you mentioned it's too early to talk about dollars, but you did say there would be no school would lose dollars under the indexation, but you're also saying quite commendably that disadvantaged schools will obviously need to get a better deal. Well, the simple mathematics of that is you're going to need a lot more funding. Given the country's preoccupation with budget surpluses and massive infrastructure backlogs, how confident are you you'll be able to get what will be significant additional funding for the commendable goal of money for disadvantaged students?
Well, I guess my answer to that question is to say that I am very confident that what the Gonski Review report has provided for us is a powerful case for change. I'm also confident that there is significant public and education stakeholder support for us to do the work to see what a proposed model might look like. I'm equally confident that if I were to venture any further speculation, as your question invites me to, then I might unbalance what I think has been a very balanced debate. So I will demur on that point.
I'm interested by, and I must admit, I was drawn a bit from seeing an article on Lakeline, and I think it had a senior member from the Finland or the Finnish school system, and that's held up.
Pasi Salberg was the gentleman's name.
Yes, yes.
That's right.
And they said one thing, a couple of things that he discussed is it's quite a desirable profession over there, quite well paid. Maybe you can give me sort of an example of, and I haven't got Finn on the spot, but.
No.
I would just be interested to know a little bit more about the Finnish system, and I'm just thinking about like what are their school hours, and are they there longer? How much are the teachers paid? Like, sort of, the guide in terms of volume dollars, and sort of what do you think are the main sort of success factors there, or what do you like to implement here?
So the question is, what do you think of Finland?
Well, look, I think it's a very interesting country in a number of respects, not only because of its education reforms. If you consider where it has sat historically and the way in which they really did sit down and think long and hard about how they might approach the configuration of their economy, what skill sets they needed and what priorities they were going to give to things like education. And I think, just to repeat again before I answer some of the detail of the question where I can... They spent a lot of time thinking about what they were going to do, and they've spent a lot of time bringing it into fruition. Amongst the features, though, are a very strong emphasis on lifting both the status the qualifications and to some extent the remuneration, though not, I don't think the remuneration has been a particularly significant element of that, of teachers. I mean, a teacher teaching in a Finnish school effectively has the equivalent of a Masters of Education and is seen in the community as having that high status. And interestingly, to segue to Australian teachers for a second, when you look at some of the research that's done on Australian teachers, it is the case that for teachers, the level of remuneration is not the principal driver for them taking up that vocation. Now, these are people that have a genuine desire to teach kids, to give kids an opportunity in life. They do enable a fair amount of local autonomous involvement with schools and school communities in a different way to perhaps what we're proposing, but I can think we can say safely in general terms that autonomy is a feature of what they do. And they're very focused on learning from example and very focused on learning from practice. So there is a great deal of sharing good teaching practice, both within schools and more broadly. But they've been at it for, I don't know how many years, but I'm thinking it's at least 30 years. And it's been something which they've been committed to effectively in a bipartisan way. And in my view, we need to work towards that approach, if nothing else. I think we've got other things to learn from them, but if nothing else, because we do need to have general agreement about not only the priorities that we're going to place on education from the point of view of appropriations in the future, or as it may be, but also, in a way, a deeper thing, you know, the cultural support that we're going to give to education. And there, the cultural support to education is very strong.
The Gonski report, which was spoken about so articulately, was an independent report in what seems to me a very difficult area. You've said how positively you have considered it and how you want to put it forward. Are there any parts of it that you're not positive about, that you want to drop and not consider?
Oh, no, well, look, it's a very fair question. And you're right, it was an independent report, and I think that we can be very thankful that Mr. Gonski and his panel had the sufficient level of expertise and the space to do the work that they did. When the report was released, the government did make one specific comment in relation to the recommendations of the report. The recommendations of the report suggest that the Commonwealth Government should potentially take a greater role in the capital funding area. On the back of a 16 and a bit billion dollar investment in school infrastructure, capital investment that the Commonwealth had made through the Building the Education Revolution, the government provided an appropriate but qualified response to that recommendation. We didn't rule it out altogether. We said we would continue to consider capital funding in the terms in which they are currently undertaken by the Commonwealth, because there is some capital funding in the appropriation. But we also indicated in a cautionary expression that we weren't of a mind to take up the full extent of that recommendation now.
Minister, you've talked about the on 2007, the government introduced the program of 6.5 million to computers and also the $2.5 billion in education. Has that led to much higher standards of education improvements over that period? I mean, in terms of compared to the OECD, as you mentioned, after spending so much, and given that the government has so much regulation over the states, that might cause some inflexibility. So if the state wants to make an anti-bullying program to make the school environment more safer, so call line for teachers to call in to find out their legal rights.
So the question is, has the investment in computers led to a positive result in terms of educational outcomes? And secondly, is there a problem with the Commonwealth being in a situation where override the state in relation to certain matters, including bullying or whatever?
Look, I'll try and give a reasonably succinct answer to what is actually a question which has got quite a lot of dimension in it. We're seeing some good and very positive results as a consequence of the investment that we've made in the national partnerships. Most schools that I go to, and it wouldn't surprise you, but it's very important to hear it firsthand, not only have welcomed the additional investment, but are particularly proud of the way in which they've utilised the resources that have been made available to them, and often point out either arresting a decline that they were seeing, for example, in the primary years with both literacy and numeracy, and my speech referred to some improvements, some really significant improvements on a school's basis, but also the specific techniques or practices that they brought into the school that they believe will continue to produce great results in the future. Now, it's important to say that one of the purposes of the national partnerships was to identify things that worked and things that didn't. And in some school systems and in some schools, principals, who are the leaders in the school, were encouraged to try different things to see what worked and what didn't. Let me give you two examples of things that have worked through the national partnerships. One which is very close to my heart, in Indigenous education, a school in far north Queensland, I won't name the school, but it's in far north Queensland, with a large percentage of Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islander and Islander students, significantly improving their literacy and numeracy in the primary years by making sure that two things happened. The first is that each child had a personalised learning plan and they had the resources to make sure that that was done. And secondly, that they were able to provide early intervention if they saw that a child, for example, was struggling with language, with spoken and written English, the employment of literacy coaches in order to provide that early intervention. And their NAPLAN results, which are published on my school, reflected the benefit of that investment. One other example, take a very large government school which may have a student population of around 1,000 or more kids. A school that perhaps is drawing from quite a diverse schooling community in terms of ethnic background, and where there are many challenges, particularly with people recently arrived in Australia, or those for whom education and application to education is not the norm. The principal of a particular school, again in Queensland, determined that the best way, in this case, that he could lead his school to address those challenges was to deploy the tasks of managing the school's finances and organising the rosters and negotiating with the bus company and making sure that the sports fields, the lawns, you know, all to a chief financial officer. So he used some of his national partnership money to employ a chief financial officer to take care of all of the administrative running issues around a school. It's a lot to do in a school of that size. He then concentrated, as a teacher, on working with his teachers to address the issues in the classroom that he thought were most important. And as he said to me, it was one of the most important things he was ever able to do, because he was freed from the burden of running the school and got to be a teaching leader again. We will evaluate these national partnerships, and we do go through a process of evaluation, and we will be able to identify what did and didn't work for state systems in particular, as the states run the government school systems, and there's shared learning for teachers there to pick up on the things that did work and do them themselves. Just quickly on the question the gentleman asked about regulation, use the example of the bullying policy. I think the key for the national government in education reform is to get the design, the architecture and the policy right. Make sure that that stuff is done in a way which gives you national confidence that the education system is the best it can be. We do know that bullying, particularly cyberbullying, is an issue of growing concern, particularly for parents of younger students. So we have a specific strategy for bullying and safety at school. It's called the National Safe Schools Strategy. And we work with state governments and school systems so that schools are informed of the elements or components that they need to have working in their school to manage those issues. Now, some of those will be different state to state and from system to system. We provide the framework for that to happen. It's not bureaucratically cumbersome. It does require some political will on the part of state systems to make sure that their schools are doing it, and it requires teachers and principals in the schools to put it into practice. But it is something which, if it's properly given effect to, can make a real difference, not only to the comfort level of parents sending their kids to schools, but to kids and teachers if they find that they're in a bullying situation.
Not a quick question. It's about a year and a half to the next election. What are the remaining priorities up in that period?
Well, Jared, I think that the Gonski review is clearly, and the work that we're doing now is clearly, an extremely important and central part of what we want to do in education. Not only this year, but going up to the next election. There, I would identify another three or four things that I think are equally important in terms of the amount of effort we want to provide to them. The first is the work that we're doing with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students. And here, as some of you will know, we do have specific closing the gap targets. One of the ways in which we can make sure that we are able to meet those closing the gap targets is through education. I consider both school attendance and satisfactory education for Indigenous kids to be the single most important thing that a young Aboriginal person in this country needs to do. They need the support of their community, they need the support of the school community, and we need to make sure that we have the mechanisms in place to get those kids through the school system. And we've invested additional money, including through a Queensland educationist, Chris Sara, on additional focus schools there. The third thing that I would refer to sits around the area of digital learning. The fact is that the classroom that, well, I'm probably some of us here are of my generation. I mean, I can remember squeaky chalk and what it did to, the hairs on the back of what was then the hairs on the back of my head. But the fact is that nowadays, well, there are whiteboards, but kids are highly digitally literate. Use of handheld devices is very common. We've provided a significant tranche of computers into those schools. But the key here is going to be the linkage between the technologies, the rollout of the national broadband network, which will be very important, particularly in some areas, and making sure that the school community and the teachers in the classroom are utilising the accessibility resources that come with digital learning. Just to say one thing I didn't say in the speech. The Australian curriculum is the world's only national online curriculum. And we are developing a set of teaching resources that would be accessible by teachers and the teaching community in any part of Australia to complement that national curriculum. So whilst the Gonski review itself wasn't specifically asked questions around those matters, it did provide, I think, some welcome comments about our reforms. This is clearly going to be an important area in the future. And to be frank, it's one that bears down upon the questions of quantums of support, appropriations at Commonwealth, state, and through system levels as well. Because there are some things that you really can do very economically effectively through the provision of online teaching accessibility. I think it's especially important in two areas. One is in arresting some of the troubling areas that we have in terms of the numbers of students that are studying maths and science. We've got a low number of students who are graduating in maths and science, and we've got small numbers of teachers of maths and science. That's one area. And the second is for children in remote areas. So a promising student in a language, for example, who's living in Broken Hill may not have access to the language teacher in Broken Hill, but of course with video conferencing, decent broadband width, they can receive the appropriate level of teaching, even though their teacher's sitting in Tasmania.
Many thanks. Well, all cabinet ministers are very busy, and Peter Garrett is a very busy cabinet minister. We're very grateful he could come along tonight to give an important speech. Without question, there's been a great deal of reform in education over the period of this Labor government, both under Julie Gillard when she was education minister, and now under Peter Garrett when it's his responsibility.
And from the last question the Minister took, it's pretty clear that there's more work in line. So we're very grateful for you coming along tonight, giving us an important talk, following on the issues of the Gonski report, but going beyond that to the various other parts of school education. We hope you'll come back again in the future, but for tonight, well done and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.